quinoa and brown rice mix that you can just heat in the microwave. If you had to, you could even eat the stuff cold. This is why it's nice to call ahead, though, and find out if you're going to have a microwave in your room. The pouches don't need to be refrigerated, and they're never going to leak, so they're really ideal for travel. Baggies of dry cereal, like shredded wheat, Uncle Sam's, Ezekiel, or Fiber One, are also ideal. You could also just bring packets of oatmeal. Vegetables. Veggies are a little trickier because they're often heavy and or bulky. But packages of baby carrots or sugar snap peas work well. You can also cut up broccoli florets or other vegetables that you could eat as finger foods and put them in baggies. Fats. Half an ounce of nuts or seeds is the easiest fat serving for traveling. Meat and dairy products that travel well. You might not think of meat and dairy as being foods that travel well, but there are some that really do. The classic example is hard-boiled eggs. They last a very long time, even without refrigeration. You can quickly boil up a dozen, and that's 6 easy protein servings if you're female, or 4 protein servings if you're male. Just dry them off, put them in a baggie, and pack them in your suitcase or bring them in your carry-on. Another really good option is cheese, especially pre-packaged string cheeses, which often come in exactly 1 ounce servings. Pack 2 if you're female, 3 if you're male, and that is a very convenient protein serving that travels well and lasts a long time without refrigeration. Tuna fish pouches also work well. Food lasts. When I was first starting Brightline Eating, I moved to Sydney, Australia. And during the 2 years that I lived there, the first and foremost travel lesson that I learned is that food does not go bad nearly as quickly as we've been conditioned to believe it does. I traveled back and forth to the States 4 times and went all the way around the world once, and I packed all my meals for those flights. One time, I had a day and a half of straight travel time from America back to Sydney, thanks to a 13-hour layover in Tokyo, and I ended up sitting down to eat salmon 41 hours after I had cooked and packed it. No ice, no insulated bag, and no refrigeration. It was perfectly fine. Food doesn't go bad as quickly as you think. I'm not adding a disclaimer here. I'll leave you to your own common sense. Crossing time zones. The second lesson that I learned, traveling from Sydney to America and back, is how to space out meals while traveling internationally. At home, standard meal times might be breakfast at 7 o'clock, lunch at noon, and dinner at 6 o'clock, something like that. Basically, you're eating every 5 or 6 hours, but then you don't eat overnight, which is usually for about 13 hours. So the first time I made the trip, I spaced out my meals just like that. I did breakfast, lunch, and dinner 4 to 6 hours apart, and then left a big gap before the next breakfast. It did not go well. I wasn't sleeping for 8 hours of that long stretch, so it was incredibly torturous waiting that long to eat. What I've learned is that when you're traveling, you've got to count all flight time as awake time. Traveling across time zones is grueling. I never set myself up now to be going 8 or 10 or 13 hours without a meal if I'm traveling on an airplane. So I've developed a system for figuring out how many meals you should eat if you're traveling across multiple time zones. Now, I'm not talking about traveling across the United States, crossing only 3 time zones. If you're doing that, it's easy to still just eat your 3 meals a day. A little more spread out in one direction, a little more compressed in the other direction. But when you're crossing 6 time zones, or 10, or 16, it becomes absolutely necessary to plan out the spacing of your meals because the notions of breakfast or lunch or dinner just don't apply anymore. Night and day are going to be flip-flopping on you. So the first thing to figure out is what your last meal is going to be in the time zone that you're departing from. We're going to call this an anchoring meal. For example, suppose you're leaving from home and the flight leaves at 8 p.m. Okay, then your anchoring meal is dinner. You're going to eat dinner at dinner time a couple of hours before your flight. Your next anchoring meal relates to when you land. So let's imagine that you'll be landing at 2 p.m. local time wherever you're going. You want to fuel your body by eating lunch right before you land, since you'll have to go through customs, find your way to your destination, and get situated in whatever your new place is. Then you're going to find dinner at dinner time in your new local time zone. So now you've got your anchoring departure meal and your anchoring arrival meal. Just count all the real hours of travel time in between and divide by 6. You want to eat every 6 hours while you're flying. Now, if you have to compress it a little bit and eat every 5 hours to make it come out evenly, even every 4 hours, fine, do that. But make sure you're eating every 4 to 6 hours while you're in the air. Bring your program. I just want to remind you of something very important, which is that when you travel, you need to plan to bring your program, as well as at least some of your food. Brightline eating is portable, and the last thing you want to do is leave the pieces that give you structure at home and travel to a new location without your tools and the whole system that helps to keep you happy, thin, and free. For example, my meditation bench is the first thing I put in my suitcase. I also bring my smartphone with my Brightline Eating Daily Companion, so I've got my nightly checklist sheet, my journaling tool, my gratitude tool, my emergency action plan with the big red emergency button, my phone numbers of my buddies and my mastermind group, and access to the online support community. We are in an amazing digital age where the tools that you need to stay connected and strong are available to you wherever you go. And I have learned the hard way that it is sometimes even more important for me to use my Brightline Eating tools to stay on plan when I'm traveling than when I'm at home. Traveling is stressful, and there's often a lot packed into a day away. If I don't make sure to take care of myself mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, my willpower will get totally depleted. I'm gonna feel rough instead of relaxed. So I bring my scale, I bring my support tools, and I continue on with this way of life wherever I am in the world. It goes with me. Holidays. For many people starting Brightline Eating, holidays loom large and scary. But let's be real for a minute. Thanksgiving is just a Thursday. You can make it through any given day by sticking to your Brightlines. You just have to plan ahead and recruit lots of support. Everyone in your Brightline community is going to be facing down the same challenge at the same time. We've got you. Eat turkey for your protein, but skip the gravy, and make sure there are some simple, unadulterated vegetables. You can always contribute a dish of your own if you're eating at someone else's house. Mashed or roasted butternut squash is always delicious. Try making a gorgeous garden salad that includes some fresh pineapple, depending on whether it's lunch or dinner. If you're on the maintenance food plan and you get grain with your meal, weigh out some mashed potatoes or wild rice. If you're gonna feel awkward bringing your scale to your host's house, treat it like a restaurant meal and eyeball your portions. If you're with family and they know all about your Brightline Eating program, bring your scale and use it. It will give you peace. Actually, the traditional Thanksgiving meal lends itself to Brightline Eating quite nicely. There are almost always foods that you can eat. The tricky part is actually often the timing of the meal. Unless you feel really comfortable having lunch or dinner at 3 o'clock, you may want to talk with the host ahead of time and see if it's possible to have the meal either at 1 o'clock or maybe 5 o'clock, something that aligns better with lunch or dinner. Now, if you're thinking, no way, I couldn't do this, not on Thanksgiving, you're not alone. Many people have that response at first. Listen to this. The first boot camp I ever offered started in October. But everyone made it through that holiday and still lost their weight. Research from the National Weight Control Registry shows that people who stick to their food plan on weekends and through the holidays experience less stress and are far less likely to regain their weight. If you want to get thin and stay thin forever, then commit to sticking to your Brightlines even on special occasions. And I promise it's not going to be as bad as you think. When you get through your first holiday sticking to your food plan, you will feel great. But everyone around you will be miserable because they've eaten too much. They'll be moaning and groaning and passed out on the couch, and you'll be feeling terrific. You may even decide to ditch them and go take a brisk walk or go help with the dishes. One thing I will warn you, based on my personal experience and that of hundreds of my boot campers, is that oftentimes an addictive eater will get through a holiday, will get through a vacation, or a significant event, successfully. But then later, in the privacy of home, end up binging as a reward. It's called re-entry, and it is a real phenomenon. The time after a trip, party, or holiday is when you need to keep your guard up and be the most vigilant. Special occasions. Weddings, birthdays, and other special occasions are much easier to navigate with Brightline Eating as your guide. You already know what you're going to eat. You're going to eat what's on your food plan. The key is to figuring out how to get what you need. The first rule of thumb is to keep your meal times in mind. For example, if the wedding ceremony starts at 7 p.m., you can bet that dinner won't be served until after 9 p.m. And in my book, that's just too late. You'd be better off eating your dinner before you go. If people ask you why you're not eating, a simple, "Oh, I'm never hungry this late in the evening," will suffice. If it's a 3 p.m. birthday party, don't eat anything there and make sure you get home by dinner time. But have a dinner packed in your car just in case you end up deciding to stay late. If the event includes a meal and occurs during your normal meal time, then by all means, plan ahead to eat there. Call who's ever in charge of the food and have a frank and detailed discussion about what's on the menu. If it's a wedding, get the name of the caterer and call them. Caterers typically have no problem making accommodations for guests with special food needs. It's their job. These days, everyone is on a special diet. Celiacs, paleos, diabetics, etc. Believe me, they're totally used to it. Just talk through what they're serving and then ask for what you need. When you attend the event, remind yourself to focus on the people, not on the food. Try playing this little game. See if you can meet three new people, remember their names, and learn two interesting facts about each one of them. And remember them. Test yourself on the way home. You'll be surprised how much the added human connection will enhance your enjoyment of the evening. I also encourage you to focus on what you'll enjoy about the event now that you've begun your Brightline eating journey. Is it wearing a dress you haven't fit into for a long time? Dancing without feeling self-conscious? Feeling more confident meeting new people? So many members of our community say that what they love now about holidays and special occasions is that they really feel like they have something to celebrate. Their new life.
Case study, Nathan Denken. Highest weight, 235 pounds. Current weight, 155 pounds. Height, 6 feet, 0 inches. I'm one of those people who grew up naturally thin. And while that may seem enviable, the downside was that bad habits crept in and took hold, then eventually caught up with me. By the time I realized that I weighed 235 pounds, I had decades of poor food choices under my belt, literally. Pizza, ice cream, double bacon cheeseburgers, I loved them all. When I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, the prescribed corticosteroids accelerated my weight gain. Deteriorating discs and related spinal problems caused me to drop my calorie-burning activities. At age 66, I was diagnosed with coronary artery disease. I was certainly motivated by that. I got down to 183 6 months later. But then, 6 months after that, I was back up over 200. I truly felt stupid, although I had always considered myself to be a pretty intelligent person. I skipped a grade in elementary school and was in honors classes in high school and college. I have a PhD from Caltech in physics, and I worked at Bell Labs. But when it came to food choices, I acted like an imbecile. I realized I had done damage to my body that I was going to have to live with forever. Then, at 67, I found Brightline Eating. In many ways, the biggest blessing was finally learning why I had previously failed to keep the weight off. It may not sound like much, but when you can't accept the bad choices you were making about food for so long, knowing the reason for those choices is important. Before Brightline Eating, Even getting to 180 seemed like a stretch goal. Being able to finally set a goal weight according to where I needed to be for optimum health was amazing. Actually reaching it? There are no words. With the weight off, my triglycerides dropped 36%. My blood pressure dropped so much that I had to get off the metoprolol that I was taking for atrial fibrillation. I reduced my dose of aspirin as a blood thinner from 325 milligrams to 81 milligrams. My doctors often have more questions now about how Brightline eating works than about my health. Best of all, my energy level is greatly improved, and I sleep better. As a scientist myself, what changed my life the most was getting answers to questions I didn't even realize I had. Perhaps for the first time in my life, I understood myself and why I'd made the choices I had, even when they worked against my own self-interest. Happy, thin, and free applies to far more than my weight and food issues. This program shows me how to apply what I've learned in all my endeavors to live a happier and healthier life.
Chapter 13. What if I break my bright lines? You might assume that it's not a question of if, but when. However, I know many people who've gone 30 or even 40 years without ever crossing their bright lines. Once you establish bright line eating as a lifestyle, there is absolutely no need for you to break your bright lines. Ever. One day at a time. This is a point I really want to emphasize because people often fail to realize how truly possible it is to stick to their food plan for years without deviating. Not because you're fanatical, just because it works. Do you remember the discussion in Chapter 7 about how ingrained habits don't drain our mental energy, like brushing your teeth twice a day for years on end? It's the same. In fact, I want to expand on this analogy a bit because I think it's illustrative. Many of us brush our teeth twice a day, every day. And while I'm sure we all believe it's a worthwhile behavior, we probably don't think of it as being the foundation of our happiness, health, and sanity. We also don't imagine that some great tragedy would transpire if we skipped brushing occasionally. Yet we stick with it, faithfully, morning and night, day after day, because A, we believe we're better off brushing our teeth than not, and B, once the habit is established, it's easy to stick with. And the benefits of bright line eating go way beyond decent breath and healthy gums. For many, adhering to the basic habits of this program triggers a cascade of powerful transformations. Stubborn weight that clung for decades melts off. The need for medications vaporizes. Energy soars. Chronic health problems disappear. Self-confidence grows. Hearts burst with quiet bliss. Private jigs are danced in department store dressing rooms. Closets get organized. Dawn is greeted with wide and grateful eyes. Behind this, for many, runs a fear. A niggling uncertainty, or worse, a paralyzing panic. That one deviation from the Brightline eating food plan would send the whole structure crumbling to rubble and land us right back at square one. This fear, valid or not, rational or not, is the magnetic force that repels our fork away from any bite of food that's not on the plan. We know that no momentary satisfaction could possibly be worth it. The habits of Brightline eating become as ingrained as the habit of toothbrushing, so we get most of our steadiness for free. It's easy. Early morning flight? No worries. The baggies of travel foods are already pre-weighed from the night before and ready to toss into the knapsack. Wedding on Friday? Better call the caterer today and line up our meal. Road trip? Fun! Coolers packed. Brightline meals at rest stop picnic tables 4 to 6 hours apart get woven into the itinerary. So the combination of automaticity, extreme elation at the health joy inherent in our new lives, and horror at the thought of returning to our old existence keeps us on the beam. That said, I am well aware, after over 20 years in various different 12-step food programs and having coached thousands and thousands of people through the Brightline Eating Bootcamp, that many, many people will break their bright lines at some time or another. And the points I want to make about that are, A, it's not worth it. So if you haven't done it yet, don't. B, look at a lapse as a strengthening experience, not a catastrophe. And C, remember that you can always, always get your bright lines back, though it will be easy for some and very hard for others. I have not been perfect about sticking with my bright lines since I started this way of life. I've traveled a rocky road and done a lot of research on what works and doesn't work for my brain. I can share my personal experiences about the range of what can happen when you break your bright lines. Before I do, though, I just want to remind you that I am a 10 on the susceptibility scale, which means that the consequences for me are more dire than they would be for someone who's a 4. In fact, the lower you are on the susceptibility scale, the less likely it is that you'll choose to aim for strict adherence to the bright lines under every condition anyway. After the incident with the cake in Australia, followed by my painful and dramatic weight regain, I eventually got my Hashimoto's disease, a type of hypothyroidism, and extreme adrenal fatigue under control, and started my weight loss journey again. Once my brain healed the second time, I had a more typical bright line experience. My energy returned in full force, and I had very few cravings. As the weight came off, I felt increasingly exuberant, and after that, I followed my food plan precisely, with no breaks, for about 2 years. And then, on December 5th, 2005, while in a yoga class, I was watching the teacher do a demonstration when I suddenly blacked out with no warning and fell straight back like an oak tree. Note, I had recently given up all condiments, and more significantly, all salt, in an attempt to get as simple and pure as possible with my food. Low blood pressure runs in my family, and unbeknownst to me, my blood pressure was running about 75 over 50. I also have a condition called neurocardiogenic syncope, which means I'm prone to fainting. The solution is simple and has been prescribed now by doctor after doctor after doctor. I must salt my food. Heavily. Lesson learned. Once in the ER, I was floating in and out of consciousness for quite a long time, coming to and asking, what happened? Where am I? And my mom would explain, and then I'd be in a coma for a while again, and then I'd come to and ask again, what happened? Where am I? My brain was swelling up. In the midst of this, apparently, I told the doctors and the orderlies and the attendants, I'm a recovering drug addict. Please don't give me any drugs. According to my mother and my husband, I was quite emphatic. I said it over and over. You can't give me any drugs. I'm a recovering drug addict. Of course, when I finally regained normal consciousness, I was in excruciating pain, and I said to the first person I saw, I am in so much pain. Why haven't you given me anything for this? And they said, well, you told us not to. And I replied, that's ridiculous. I changed my mind. So they did end up giving me something to kill that pain. Thank goodness. When I got out of the hospital, I did the strangest thing. I went straight to the grocery store and I bought binge food. Lots and lots of binge food. My husband was livid. He'd been through the ringer with me and my food addiction, seen me gain all my weight, lose all my weight, gain all my weight back in Australia, and finally lose all my weight again. At that point, I had successfully abstained from sugar and flour for over 2 years. So the idea that I would throw all that away and go back to binging on ice cream and pies was horrific to him. When he asked me what I thought I was doing, I replied stubbornly, I'm hungry. I need to eat. I'm going to eat. Leave me alone. Not only did I buy ice cream and pies, but I bought cigarettes. And for the next 2.5 weeks, I just binged and smoked cigarettes. Nonstop. It was awful. Then I went to my follow-up appointment with my neurosurgeon. His first question was, are you having any issues with impulse control? I started to sob. It turned out that when my head hit the hardwood floor at that velocity, Not only did I fracture the base of my skull, but my brain slammed back and then ricocheted forward. And on the rebound forward, it hit the front of my skull, which it turns out is cragged inside, like a coral reef. The frontal lobes got bruised really badly from that impact. They were swollen, immobilized, and essentially not functioning. He said, "Your prefrontal cortex is the seat of impulse control, judgment, and decision-making, and it's useless to you right now. The swelling will take about 2 more weeks to go down, but when it does, you'll find that all the circuitry you've developed in your years of good habits will still be there. You'll be fine. But right now, you can't access that part of your brain at all." I knew what the prefrontal cortex was, of course, and all this made perfect sense to me. It was a huge relief. Sure enough, 2 weeks to the day after that doctor's appointment, I stopped eating addictively. It was like a light switch turned back on. I went back to weighing and measuring my food and sticking to my bright lines. It was easy. It's noteworthy to me that I didn't pick up any drugs or alcohol during that period of time. At that point, I'd been clean and sober for over 11 years, and my identity, on the deepest level, had become that of someone who does not ever, under any circumstances, use drugs or alcohol. Even when large parts of my brain were taken offline, another part of it worked to protect my recovery. By contrast, I'd only been off sugar and flour for a little over 2 years. My deepest identity had not yet become cemented as someone who does not eat sugar or flour under any circumstances. It's interesting, I think, how long it can take for a wholesale shift in identity to happen. It's also interesting that, toward the end of those awful days of binging and smoking, it dawned on me at some point that I couldn't even taste the food. I mean, at all. The scientist in me got curious, so I went to the store, got some supplies, and did some blindfolded taste tests. Chocolate versus vanilla ice cream? Nope, couldn't taste the difference. Then I got creative. Brie versus peanut butter? Nope, they tasted the same. Apparently, I had lost my sense of taste in the accident. But did that keep me from binging? Not one bit. On and on and on I ate, and the fact that I couldn't even taste the food was irrelevant. That's when I really internalized the fact that we don't overeat because of palatability or mouthfeel or because we love it. We overeat to scratch an itch in our brains. We might as well be injecting a needle full of sugar and flour into our arms. The neurosurgeon confirmed that I had lost my sense of smell in the accident, and with it, almost all of my sense of taste. I asked if I would ever get it back. He said he couldn't be sure. The neurons running between my nose and my brain had been severed straight through. If the break was low in the neuronal pathway, the nerves would grow back. But if it was higher up, they wouldn't. He said my odds were 50-50. I'm happy to report that over the next several years, my senses of smell and taste gradually returned. I'll never be a food critic, though, and don't ask me if a room smells funny. I have only the vaguest idea. For the next 6 years, I stuck to my bright lines without an exception. Not a single baby carrot at 3 in the afternoon, not a bite, lick, or taste off my plan. And what's interesting to me about that time is that some of the most painful and intense experiences of my whole life happened during those 6 years. It started when I was diagnosed with infertility, and we went through rounds and rounds and rounds of fertility treatments. Eventually, we got pregnant with twins. They were due on August 16th. But I went into labor on April 25th. Alexis and Zoe were born a week later, weighing under 1.5 pounds each. They spent nearly 4 months in the neonatal intensive care unit. Zoe came close to death many times. There was a 4% chance that they would both survive and both be healthy. It feels like a miracle that we made those 4% odds, and they are both doing fabulously well today. But it was a harrowing time in our lives, to say the least. And somehow, I didn't eat off my food plan. The birth of our third daughter, Maya, was nearly as horrific. But for me, not for her. She was born at full term, by C-section, but my spinal block completely wore off during the surgery, meaning 5 hours of feeling everything. And it got worse from there. 3 weeks of a spinal headache, worse than any migraine. It's caused when the hole at the spinal block insertion site doesn't close, and all your cerebrospinal fluid leaks out, leaving your brain rattling around in your skull. Bleeding ulcers from the pain meds left me vomiting up blood every day. And I had 2 3-year-olds running around needing me and a newborn keeping me up all night. And I still didn't eat off my food plan. Not once. There were times when, due to the ulcers, my Bright Line meal consisted of only 4 ounces of white rice and 8 ounces of whole milk to coat my stomach lining, but I weighed it precisely, even while doubled over in pain. And that's all I ate, not one bite more. How? I had built up a strong foundation. I had the proverbial reserves in the bank. Automaticity was in full effect, and my brain just did what it knew how to do. Write down food the night before, commit to it, eat only in exactly that, wash, rinse, repeat. So yes, it is possible to stick with the Bright Lines for years and years, no matter what life dishes up. Breaking our Bright Lines. To help you understand the Bright Line philosophy about breaking the lines, I need to give you some background context on the programs I attended that formed the kernel of Bright Line eating. As I've mentioned, the first 12-step program for food that I tried didn't take an explicit stance on sugar, flour, or other addictive foods. We met to talk about our compulsive overeating and to support each other in our individual efforts not to overeat, but everyone functioned autonomously in defining what that meant for them. There were no bright lines. In meetings, we would talk openly about the excess food we'd eaten, how we'd deviated from our plan, and what new plan we were going to try next. That was part of the culture. I experienced a lot of mutual tenderness, camaraderie, and spiritual growth, but no actual physical recovery. This was true for most of the other participants as well. I left that program just about as sick or sicker with food than I had been before I joined, and certainly way, way heavier. That was 8 years of my life. I eventually found a different 12-step program which dealt specifically with food addiction. It gave a ton of specific guidance on weighing and measuring food and rules about not eating sugar or flour. These were clear. As soon as you broke them, you were restricted from speaking at a meeting for 90 days, you couldn't do service work, you had to stop sponsoring others, and you were kicked out of your 12-step working group. That severity served to silence the narrative around discussing openly, in the community setting, what it's like to break the bright lines and then come back. I watched people who struggled to go long stretches without a deviation get closer and closer to the shadows, and feel more and more marginalized because they didn't have a voice. And I imagine that it felt isolating, shaming, and ostracizing. In Bright Line Eating, we create an environment that includes the best of both worlds. We celebrate the strength in our shared commitment to sticking with the bright lines, a commitment to no exceptions, a commitment to being unstoppable. This gives us the physical recovery we're seeking, lasting weight loss, and brilliant health. And it also results in a lot of freedom and happiness. And that's what's so counterintuitive for people who don't need Bright Line eating. Having a clear structure can lead to so much freedom. However, we also understand and celebrate the lessons we learn from moments of imperfection, and we welcome that narrative and that experience into our community. If you break your abstinence, we don't isolate you. Instead, we have a dedicated support community to help you get back on track. Others have been through the same thing, and they can help you find the lesson in your experience. We find that there's a lot of strength and insight, wisdom and healing that emerges when we remove all judgment from the community and foster only love, acceptance, and a fierce commitment to ongoing growth. The four S's. Think for a moment of all the yo-yo dieting that goes on. All the people who lose a huge amount of weight and then turn around and gain it right back. There's a lesson there. The most important part of any attempt is how you respond when you miss the mark. There is a huge difference between a successful, helpful, adaptive response to a break and an unsuccessful, unhelpful, maladaptive response. It's the difference between living the rest of your life happy, thin, and free, and retreating into the shadows to eat in shame, with another failure logged in your personal loss column. There are four key components to handling a break in our bright lines successfully, adaptively, and in a way that strengthens us. They are the four S's. Number one, speed. The first is how quickly we can do what we call in bright line eating, not resuming with an S, but resuming, R-E-Z-O-O-M-I-N-G, resume. You don't want to fall prey to the what the hell effect. This is a technical term in the psychology of eating literature for the mental phenomenon that happens in chronic dieters when they've broken their diet. It's not uncommon to think, well, I might as well eat everything under the sun since I broke my diet anyway. I'll start over on Monday. Or, I've had a bite of pizza. I might as well eat the whole pizza and half a gallon of ice cream while I'm at it. I'll start my diet again later. No, let's go get back on track. Like now, not tomorrow morning, not Monday, not on January 1st. Now. Speed. Now, to be fair, I know that not every moment is right for resuming. Sometimes we're just in the grip of our food addiction and we're simply not willing or maybe not able to stop eating. And that's okay. But even in those moments, we can watch in a detached and calculated way for an opening that will allow us to hop back onto our bright line eating path. We can pray for willingness, and we can implement the other three S's. They will help us to get back to the other side. Number two, self-talk. Can we be loving with our inner self-talk? Instead of beating ourselves up in self-flagellation, can we try talking to ourselves the way we would talk to a friend who has called us in crisis? Use the same tone with yourself that you'd use with a best friend who just sprained her ankle on a hike. You'd go get her help, rally resources, make sure she was resting and taking it easy. An example of a helpful thought is, I just ate a bunch of sugar, so I know my thinking is going to be really negative and irrational for a day or two, maybe three. My head is going to try to get me to feel desperate about everything. No spiral. Shame overeating leads to overeating. Just be gentle, kind, and encouraging. You are not a bad person. You just have a malfunctioning brain. Number three, social support. In my experience, the first thing that comes up after a break is a profound desire to isolate yourself. This manifests as not wanting to reach out to anyone. You just want to hide, eat, and deal with it alone. But that is not a good idea. Shame flourishes in silence. The most effective thing to do when you've had a break is to reach out to other people who do bright line eating and who are walking this journey with you. Let them know what happened and how you're feeling. Let them help you construct your plan to get back on track. They can probably see what you need much better than you can at the moment. You might really need a buddy or a mastermind group. I needed to commit my food each day to a human being live on the phone for a long time. If you haven't gotten enough social support so far, you might want to revisit the section on buddies and mastermind groups in Chapter 10 and start to build a posse. If the breaks keep coming and there seems to be no end in sight, if you're a 10 on the susceptibility scale and are feeling totally powerless, that's a sign you need to try something different and radical. Consider hiring a Brightline Eating coach. Examine what you've been doing so far. reread this book, and figure out how you're going to step up your game. You've got this. Number four, seek the lesson. My friend Pat Reynolds says, every break can be turned into a breakthrough. And he's right. There is almost always a powerful lesson to be found in breaking the bright lines. If we envelop ourselves in shame and isolation, we will probably miss the opportunity to learn from the lapse. After every break, you should absolutely take an inventory of your life, your mental state, your thinking, and your behavior leading up to the first bite. Odds are you're not fully using the tools available to you. Are you overly busy? Not letting yourself rest? Putting off meditation? Not using your nightly checklist sheet? Or is it something else, like you can't stand to say no to other people's food offerings and social situations? Whatever it is, it's a growth opportunity. The Permission to Be Human Action Plan. The Permission to Be Human Action Plan is a 10-question process that will help you find the lesson and growth opportunity after you've broken your bright lines. It will also have a positive, calming effect on the negative thinking that can crop up after a break. The 10 questions are included in the bonus material of this audiobook. I think you'll find this to be a very powerful recommitment process, and I encourage you to keep it with your emergency action plan or somewhere you'll always have it handy, even if that means writing it down and folding it up in your wallet. I want you to be able to access it at a party or in another social situation. Just excuse yourself to the bathroom and take yourself through the questions mentally. But I also recommend, when you can, getting somewhere private so you can write out your answers to those 10 questions. Answering them longhand will make all the difference. You may even want to post your answers in the online support community. I'm sure other people would get a lot out of your experience, and we would love to support you in your recommitment journey. I want to end this chapter by saying that there's a continuum of sticking with the bright lines. There's sticking with the bright lines perfectly from day one, which I relate to, celebrate, and honor. The moment I stopped using drugs, I committed to adhering to those bright lines. And then, on the other end of that continuum, there's struggle and barely being able to string 2 days together of bright line eating. And I relate to that, too. In Sydney, Australia, when I went from a size 4 to a size 24 in 3 months, I was actually doing everything in my power to stop eating. And I just couldn't until the tsunami of food addiction receded. It just took what it took. Both are different experiences of traveling the same path. Most of us, most of the time, experience something in the middle. Regardless, bright line eating is a community for everyone. That whole continuum of experience is welcomed here and is honored here. And there are lessons to be learned at all points of that continuum. Typically, people who are struggling feel like everyone else is more successful and no one else breaks their bright lines or is pinned down by the food the way they are. And people who have never had a break feel like everyone else is breaking and resuming, and they wonder if they're all alone in their steadfastness. But in bright line eating, none of us are alone. The reality is that every possible permutation of bright line eating is being experienced fully every day by hundreds, if not thousands, of people. But if you're doing bright line eating and it's going well, protect that. Your saboteur, I guarantee, will try to convince you to try an exception here or there. Don't fall for it. That road is slippery and painful. The knowledge that resuming is possible should absolutely not be used as an excuse to take a slight detour from the bright lines and then try to get back on track right afterward. It doesn't work like that. The first thing that happens when you break the bright lines is that your freedom evaporates instantly, and it goes downhill from there. You don't want to live a life full of the drama and the anguish of breaking and resuming. The reason we honor the bright lines and commit to living within them is because we find that consistency and structure make us happy, thin, and free. More than that, they allow us to be the people that we strive to be and to do more of the things that we want to do in life. Our focus moves beyond food. We become self-actualized and engaged with the world. That is what we all want our lives to be about. That said, if you're reading this section because you've broken your bright lines, never fear. I want you to know that you can still come back from that, and that living happy, thin, and free is still on offer for you. Because in Bright Line Eating, we are not called to be perfect. We are called to be unstoppable.
Case study, Colleen Egan. Highest weight, 197 pounds. Current weight, 142 pounds. Height, 5 feet, 9 inches. At age 5, I climbed up on a countertop to reach into the cupboard for a box of brown sugar. While I was in elementary school, my uncle worked for Frito-Lay, and he would bring over cartons of chips when he visited. I wanted to eat them all, but settled for eating as much as I could before they were taken away from me. Then, later, I would sneak back to eat some more. I was 11 when I realized eating was a problem for me. I ate more than anyone else and always wanted to keep eating when everyone else was done. I was taller than my mom, my older sisters, my brother, and my girlfriends. I was called the Jolly Green Giant by a boy in the neighborhood, and that label stuck for many years. In high school, we all wanted to be like Twiggy. We tried not to eat so we could all be just as thin. That didn't work. But since Twiggy was so revered in the media, she became the model to emulate. I internalized that I was huge and a failure. As I got older, I started hiding my eating, all the while binging on sugar and flour. I also think that the commercial introduction of frozen convenience foods and fast foods during my youth had a huge impact on me. Easy grab and go. No preparation needed. Just put it in the oven. And later, the microwave. If one is not enough, it's easy to make another. They're small, after all. I remember when it became unpopular to cook. The media only showed the benefits of processed foods. As I aged, I invested more and more energy into trying to lose weight. I bought multiple books and magazines and would follow their plans to some short-lived effect. I tried quick-loss schemes like the cabbage soup diet. I even tried eating only ice cream, cookies, and cake to try and make myself develop an aversion to them. It didn't work. I started serving meals on smaller plates. I tried putting my fork down between bites and chewing my food for a ridiculously long time. I tried to drink a liter of water before dinner. I ate only one meal a day. I ate an apple 1 hour before dinner. I switched to low-fat processed foods. I ate only packaged food so I could accurately measure my calories. Yuck. I read labels and tried to avoid things with high sugar content and hydrogenated oils. I started using olive oil, the healthy oil. I listened to people who I thought had the answers and tried to follow their advice. I tried to eat healthfully. I went on vacation with one of my sisters, who controls her weight, but when I tried to mimic her eating pattern, I found it just wasn't enough food for me. I desperately tried to find the balance. Nothing ever worked. I got more and more frustrated, angry, and disillusioned. Then, a few years ago, just after the New Year, I decided I could not make any more weight loss goals. I could not diet anymore. I gave away my collection of over 30 diet and nutrition books. I would not go back to Weight Watchers or Jenny Craig. I just could not face any more deprivation, rebound weight gain, or failure. I resolved to accept myself as I was. I just didn't believe I was capable of controlling my eating. At the same time, I knew I had to improve my overall health. I had high cholesterol and pre-diabetes. It was a time of great conflict for me. My doctor said if I didn't lose weight, she'd just have to keep increasing my medications until I finally wound up on insulin. But I couldn't lose weight. After 40 years of dieting, I was still more than 30 pounds overweight. I decided to try to learn how to cook vegetables via an online cooking class with Katie May in the hope that increasing my vegetable intake would help, somehow. That vegan cooking class was the turning point. Several weeks in, Susan Pierce Thompson showed up as a surprise guest speaker. Serendipity. I felt understood, finally. The science she presented made sense. I knew I was high on the susceptibility scale. I took one more chance with altering my diet, and it worked. I'm still working it. When I started Brightline Eating, my A1C was down to 5.2 from 5.6, but I was taking metformin. At that time, I was also taking simvastatin and had total cholesterol of 307 with triglycerides 126, LDL 216. I stopped the metformin when I started Brightline Eating. 6 months later, after having lost 30 pounds, my A1C was 4.9. I also stopped taking simvastatin when I started Brightline Eating. 6 months later, my total cholesterol was 205, and 1 year later, it's 193, with triglycerides down at 73 and LDL at 113. My HDL remained unchanged and averages 65 to 66. I love how I feel. I love not having to struggle with clothes. I feel a level of confidence that I never had before. I'm enjoying the variety and quantity of foods that I eat. I'm able to entertain, dine out, and travel while maintaining my bright lines. Best of all, I'm more calm and accepting now. I'm more gentle and honest with myself and with others. I'm not as driven to get it right, which has improved all my relationships. I truly feel like I got a second chance at life.
Part 5. Goal Weight, Maintenance, and Beyond. Chapter 14. Getting to Goal Weight. You might be surprised to find a whole chapter devoted to this topic. You might be thinking, I'll just do the weight loss food plan until I'm thin, and then I'll switch to the maintenance plan. Easy. But actually, it's a little more complex than that. This chapter is all about ensuring a smooth transition from one to the other. We don't want you to fall short of your goal or blow right past it and have people start to ask if you have cancer. This has happened frequently enough that now I make sure to spell out how to slow your weight loss. To start, we'll talk about how to figure out your goal weight. Goal weight. Right off the bat, I'll mention that your goal weight is likely to be much lower than you think it is. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not here to force you to get skinnier than you feel comfortable being, nor to say that skinnier is better. It's just that over and over, I've found that people's idea of what's possible for them, or maximally healthy for them, has been skewed by years and years of being overweight and trying and failing to change. Understandably, they're cautious about setting a bold, unbiased goal. They've lost sight of what a right-sized body really is for them, and that's okay. The point is that Brightline Eating restores choice in the matter. You choose your goal weight. Personally, I've found a point at which my body disappears in my mind's eye. I hardly think about it. When I sit down, I don't wonder whether rolls are visible from the side. When I get dressed, I consider the color and the cut and the style or comfort of my clothes instead of worrying about whether it conceals bulges or bunches. If you've ever been in a right-sized body as an adult, even if you have to think back to high school or college, the weight you were at then is probably your goal weight. And I don't care if you're now 70 years old. You'll get there. Go ahead and laugh. I've seen it happen too many times to have any doubts. If you've never been in a right-sized body as an adult, you can try using a formula to get a general sense of what to aim for. As an aside, There are many ideal weight formulas, and you can find them online. One of the earliest was provided by Broca, Paul, Memoir d'Anthropologie, Paris, the same Dr. Broca who discovered Broca's area. The formula is approximately 100 pounds for women or 110 pounds for men for the first 60 inches or 5 feet tall of height, plus 5 pounds for each inch above that. To cover variations in body composition, Broca suggested that the desirable weight would be within 15% of the calculated number. Oftentimes, my boot campers will just set an initial goal weight, knowing full well they may reevaluate as they get closer. I think that's a perfectly reasonable strategy. Sometimes setting the true goal weight at first just freaks people out. I worked with a woman recently who's 5'2", and she's never been under 200 pounds as an adult. The idea that her goal weight might be somewhere between 110 and 115 pounds is just too weird for her to sit with. Odds are she'll get there, but initially she's setting 140 as her goal weight, and that's fine. What seems impossible right now might seem effortlessly within reach 6 months from now. So, once you've zeroed in on your goal, how do you get down there? Over the years of working with people, I've come to think of it like landing a plane. You've been cruising along at altitude on the weight loss food plan for quite a while, and now you need to make some careful calculations to arrive at your destination. You can't keep circling the airfield indefinitely. Some things need to change to land this plane. And you want it to be a soft landing. I'm going to be the flight controller who helps you coast right down to the runway and live at your dream destination forever. Plateaus in weight loss. Certain individuals with low basal metabolic rates can experience plateaus in their weight loss. But don't freak out if your weight hasn't changed for a week. A plateau means not losing any weight for more than 4 weeks straight with immaculate bright lines. If it happens, less food is required. For starters, avoid nuts, starchy veggies, and fatty proteins. If after 2 weeks weight loss hasn't kicked in, make the following modifications in sequence, spaced 2 weeks apart. First, replace both breakfast and lunch fruit with 6 ounces of steamed greens. If needed, then reduce lunch and dinner fats to 1 teaspoon. If needed, then reduce all proteins to 3/4 of a serving if you're female, or 2/3 of a serving if you're male. Keep your bright lines bright. At the commencement of maintenance, the foods may be restored in the reverse order they were removed until a stable goal weight is achieved. Slowing your weight loss. If your weight loss is humming along, then at some point you'll need to transition to maintenance. The general idea is to gradually add more food to your plan until your weight loss tapers off and you are exactly at the weight you want to be. It's a process. First, once you are 10 pounds from your goal weight, you need to start weighing yourself at least weekly. Monthly weighing isn't frequent enough to give you the data you need. Daily is fine too, but for this transition process, it's the weekly numbers you want to focus on. The key factor for determining your next steps is to figure out, on average, how fast you are losing weight. The options are super fast, fast, medium, and slow. Super fast is 2.5 to 3 pounds or more per week. Men are way more likely to fall into that category. Fast is 2 pounds per week on average. Medium is 1.5 pounds per week on average. And slow is 1 pound or less per week. If your weight loss has slowed down over time, use your current rate of weight loss. Once you've determined your category, you're ready to read on. As you're thinking about this, remember, as I explained in Chapter 8, it's a myth that it's not healthy to lose weight fast. Nor should you despair if you are slower to lose. We're all on the same happy, thin, and free journey. And for all of us, the maintenance phase of the trip is the longest part by far. In each and every case, the weight loss phase is precious and relatively short. Some just transition sooner than others. It's not necessarily a blessing. Each trajectory has benefits. To glide gently into maintenance, add food in the order I'm going to suggest in a moment. Keep in mind that if you're averse